Garth Leach felt well pleased with the results of the raid on the wagon train as he rode back between Ike and Yellow Cat. Primarily instigated for revenge purposes, it had provided some surprising gains, too. True, he had derived a certain amount of pleasure in the punishment of Cora and Jeb Hawkins, but the real bonus came with the acquisition of Hawkins' saddle. Fine Spanish leather. It was too fine for the likes of a drifter like Hawkins.
He probably stole it. Fits my bandages right, too.
The real surprise came with the discovery of the canvas sack in the saddlebag.
What are you grinning about?
I'll tell you later.
As yet, no one else knew about the gold coins, and Garth preferred not to tell the Kiowa chief riding beside him. Yellow Calf might want him to share the coins, and Garth knew the savage chief had no notion of the value of the gold. He might want them just because they were shiny. Besides, Yellow Calf ought to be pleased enough the raid had resulted in horses and some additional weapons, as well as food supply and tools. All things considered, everybody should be pleased with the raid, except Joe, who shuffled along behind him, nursing the wound in his shoulder.
Damn fool for getting himself shot.
Well, he ain't got a hell of a lot more sense than Jesse. I've been wondering about that other fella, that partner of Hawkins. I'm wondering, where the hell is he? He oughtn't be too far away. He might have heard the shooting.
Hell, what if he did? Even if he finds him, ain't nobody gonna tell him what happened. He'll just think it was Injuns.
Maybe. But I'd have liked it better if he'd been there so as we could have put his ass under with the rest of them. I don't trust that feller. He's just too damn quiet and a lot more dangerous than his partner.
Hell, he ain't nothing to worry about. I expect he'll hightail it out of these parts when he finds his friends laying there with their top knots missing.
When they approached the ribbon of trees that lined the banks of the river where Yellow Calf's village lay, Chief rode on ahead to join his warriors' triumphant return. Yellow Calf was greatly pleased with the success of the raid. He had suffered no losses and only a few wounded. The massacre added to his esteem as a war chief. Holding their horses to a walk as the Kiowa charged victoriously into their village, four brothers took their time reaching the camp.
When the hell are we getting out of here? We got about all we're gonna get from Yellow Calf, and I don't cotton to hanging around any longer.
Hell, I wouldn't mind hanging around a while longer. Maybe we could go on another raid with Yellow Calf's Injuns.
God, I swear, I believe you got some wild Injun blood in you.
We're leaving in the morning. Just as soon as we load them buffalo hides in the wagons, we'll head out to Fort Lyon and sell them. Then we'll head up to Denver City, maybe.
What about my shoulder? I'm hurting awful bad.
Stop your belly aching, Joe. You ain't gonna die from a little lead in your shoulder. When we get to Yellow Calf's, Ike'll dig it out.
I wish there was a doctor around here.
Ike's all the doctor you need. If you'd have kept your eye on the man with the gun instead of looking at Cora, you wouldn't have a pistol slug in your damn shoulder.
We could let the Kiowa medicine man take it out. He'd probably wave an eagle feather over a couple of times and then chop it out with a war axe.
I have a mind to put a bullet in your shoulder.
The wound was no laughing matter to the youngest of the four brothers. It was painful. The shoulder was swollen and inflamed all around the bullet hole. There was no question that the bullet would have to be removed.
Oh, sweet Jesus! Yeah!
In a teepee at the camp, Ike's blade probed into the hole made by Jeb's bullet. Joe's back was arching in an effort to pull away.
Hold him, Jesse!
Ike's incision caused a fresh stream to spread over blood already dried around the wound. He pushed the skinning knife in deeper, searching for the lead slug.
This ain't nothing. If we raided to this thing really got red and puffy, then you'd have something to moan about.
Your cutting is worse than it was to get shot.
Wait, I felt it that time. Now, if I can just work it loose a little bit.
I kept working the bullet back and forth, trying to dislodge it from the muscle.
Oh, hurry up. I don't feel so good.
It might have been better for Joe had he not watched the knife probing around in the bloody mess Ike had created out of the neat black bullet hole. As it was, however, the pain, the sight of his own blood, and the excessive quantity of rot-gut whiskey he had consumed rendered him queasy.
Uh-oh, I could smell it coming! Yo!
Jesse released his hold on Joe and jumped back to avoid the disgusting gusher that erupted from Joe's mouth.
You son of a bitch!
Ike was not so lucky, being the recipient of the major portion of his brother's stomach contents. Revolted by Joe's sudden discharge, he fairly thrust his knife in angry reprisal, cutting the muscle away from the bullet. Seeing the slug free then, he picked it out with his fingers and flung it at his patient.
Well, there's your damn bullet!
Ike stormed out of the teepee, heading for the river.
Oh, don't leave me like this, damn it! I need a bandage or something. I'm bleeding like hell.
One of the Kiowa spectators, like the other warriors, puzzled by the bizarre treatment of a bullet wound, turned and left the teepee. A few minutes later, he returned with a young Indian woman. Looking at Joe, he pointed to his shoulder.
She fix.
The woman immediately knelt down and began to cleanse the wound with a wet cloth she had brought with her. In a short time, the wound was cleaned and bandaged. She favored Joe with a faint smile and quickly withdrew from the teepee. The Kiowa who had brought her nodded his head in approval before he turned and followed her. At sunup the following morning, Garth was ready to depart the Kiowa village. The wagons loaded with hides stood ready to roll, with Jesse driving one and Ike the other. The only missing brother was Joe. Irritated, Garth stalked into the teepee to find Joe still in his blanket.
Get your ass out here! I ain't waiting around here for your lazy ass!
Damn it, Garth, my shoulder's hurting too much to ride. I need a day or two more, and I got a bad sick from that rotten whiskey I drunk last night.
Your shoulder's hurting? Why ain't waiting while you lay around this camp? If you ain't some, hell, you won't be sitting on your damn shoulder. Get up from there.
I said I ain't fit to ride yet. I'm staying here for a couple of days.
Suit yourself. Me and the boys are leaving right now.
Fine, goddammit. I'll catch up with you in Fort Lyon.
Garth made no reply. Joe thought about the wisdom of his decision, but he told himself that his shoulder did need more rest. Besides, the young Kiowa woman who tended his wound had a way about her that sparked his interest. As he had hoped, the young woman came to him in the afternoon to look at his wound. Earlier, food had been brought for him by an older woman. She spoke enough English to tell him that the young woman was Little Elk's daughter, Wren.
Good?
Wren nodded toward the bandage.
It's sore. Not so good.
Not good?
Trying his best to converse with her with hand motions and the few words she knew, he finally made her understand that he was weak and needed more rest.
I come back.
Yeah, you come back.
Joe watched her leave, his eyes focused upon her slender behind. She was little more than a girl, just like Cora was when he took her from her daddy. Joe preferred him that way. He had several other visitors during the day, including Yellow Calf. The Kiowa chief was more concerned with the possibility of acquiring more ammunition for his rifles than the progress of Joe's healing. He was polite to the youngest of the Leech brothers because of that need for cartridges. In truth, he had no respect at all for the shifty-eyed white man, primarily because of Joe's capitulation to a simple shoulder wound. A real warrior would have been able to fight the next day after such a slight wound, instead of lying around the teepee being attended to by women. As far as Joe was concerned, the shoulder was already feeling much improved since the bullet had been removed. In fact, he planned to leave the following day, but only after he had taken care of a little piece of business that had dominated his thoughts ever since Wren had changed his bandage that afternoon. He went to sleep that night thinking about the slender Kiowa girl. The next morning, she came just as she had promised. After examining his wound, she smiled at him, nodding for emphasis.
Good? Wound good?
Yeah, wound good. Now I need to wash up, but I'm gonna need some help.
She couldn't understand what he was saying, so he tried to convey the message with motions. It required several attempts on his part, but she finally understood that he wanted her to help him down to the river.
Good. I take.
He wasted no time strapping on his gun belt and following Wren out of the teepee. Several of the villagers nodded politely to him as he passed through the ring of lodges. He barely acknowledged their greetings, his eyes captured by the trim behind moving briskly toward the water's edge. When she turned to lead him toward a few men bathing in the river, he quickly took her arm and pulled her toward a willow thicket farther upstream. Making motions to show that he was shy, he was able to convince her that he sought privacy for his bath. She paused, finally understanding his message, and nodded up and down vigorously. Then she pointed toward the willows, a questioning look upon her face. He answered with a wide grin and nodded in reply. Slightly amused by the strange behavior of the white man, she led him behind the screen of trees to a grassy bank, smiling to herself that it was the place where the women bathed. Once out of sight of the village, she stopped, pointed toward the riverbank, then turned to leave him.
Whoa, wait a minute. Nah.
Joe grabbed her arm. Though unsuspecting before, she recognized the leer now in his eyes as he pulled her toward the bank, his malevolent grin plainly conveying his intentions.
No!
No hell. Little tease looking at me so sweet. You knew damn well what I wanted, and you damn sure came back behind the trees with me.
Joe clamped hard on her arm and tried to force her down to the ground.
You think I'm gonna beg you for it, you crazy as hell?
Thinking to take what he wanted, he grabbed her skirt and tried to pull it up.
God damn it, shut up!
He punched her hard in the face. Stunned momentarily, she sank to the ground. Dropping to his knees before her, he snatched feverishly at her skirt, pulling it up to reveal slender thighs above her doe-skin leggings. Wild now with lust, he fumbled with his belt while she began to recover from the blow that had sent her reeling. Horrified, she looked up to see her assailant hurriedly pulling down his pants. The scream was choked off by his hand on her throat.
You just like Coral. Both of you pretend you don't want it.
Her eyes wide with horror, she struggled for breath as he forced his way between her legs. Bright morning sun seemed to suddenly fade over her, making her think she was losing consciousness. In fact, it was a shadow, caused by the formidable figure that suddenly appeared behind her attacker. In the next instant, the hand that threatened to crush her throat was released as Joe's head was yanked violently back, pulling him forcefully off the girl. Tanner dragged the would-be rapist several yards by the hair of his head before slamming him to the ground. Joe rolled over and scrambled to his feet, only to be knocked flat on his back by a crushing right hand. Joe tried to scramble up on his knees again in an attempt to run. Tanner calmly stepped forward.
I counted 7 bullet holes in Jeb Hawkins' body. Was that before or after the knife slashes on his arms and face?
It wasn't me that done it. It was Jesse and Garth. It's them you want.
Is that so? And you had nothing to do with it, right?
That's right. I had nothing to do with it. Killed Hawkins and Cora, too, they did, and then they went to Fort Lyon.
Much obliged.
I didn't have nothing to do with it. You can let me go.
I'm gonna let you go to hell. Jeb is waiting for you. Don't be afraid, miss. I ain't gonna hurt you.
Knowing now the other three he hunted were on their way to Fort Lyon, Tanner had no more time to waste. It could only be a matter of minutes before someone from the girls' village would appear. If they hadn't heard her scream, they surely would have heard the rifle shot. He had less time than he thought, for before he could turn to leave, two men of the village appeared at the edge of the willows. They were followed almost immediately by half a dozen or more armed warriors.
Well, Jeb, I sent one of them your way, but I reckon I'll be right behind them.
Stopped abruptly by the sight of the broad-shouldered white man standing solidly before them, his feet spread wide, his rifle held ready, one of the two Kiowa men held up his hand to halt the warriors. The girl ran to meet her father. Little Elk looked down at Wren, then at the body lying by the riverbank. Then his eyes were drawn back to the mysterious stranger who stood watching him like a silent, avenging spirit. He glanced down to see that the morning sun had cast a spirit shadow toward his feet like a dark finger pointing directly to him. Thinking this might be a warning from the spirit of the sun, he cautioned the warriors behind him.
Wait! Let us find out what manner of man this is before we kill him.
He saved my life. The dirty one with the shoulder wound attacked me and was choking me. This one killed him.
Looking again at Tanner, Little Elk was still cautious. The sun behind Tanner caused his face to lie deep in shadow from the hat pulled low on his forehead. The effect was almost eerie.
You did not harm the girl?
I came for this one only.
Having heard the rifle shot, others came to the riverbank, led by the chief, Yellow Calf. Surprised to find the lone white man standing motionless and silent, his face absent expression. Yellow Calf immediately looked to Little Elk for explanation.
I think he was sent from the spirit world to save my daughter and to kill the wounded white man.
Little Elk's word jolted the Kiowa chief's sensibilities. Thinking of the murderous raid he and his warriors had just made upon the white wagon train, he took another long look at Tanner, still standing apparently fearless as if ready to battle the entire village.
Maybe he has come because of the white people we killed. He said he came only for the white man.
Yellow Calf was inclined to kill the strange man, but Little Elk was a wise man and what he said might be true. It would be best to be cautious. Yellow Calf turned to Tanner.
Is it true you were sent to kill the white man?
I came for this one.
Yellow Calf looked at Little Elk and nodded solemnly. He, too, was convinced that man or spirit, Tanner had been sent to protect the girl and rid the earth of a vile and evil white man.
We thank you for the girl's life. Go in peace.
Surprised and completely confused by the chief's words, Tanner did not immediately withdraw. He hesitated for a moment while he thought the situation over. His mind up to that point had been dedicated totally to revenge upon those who had murdered Jeb and the others, and this included the Kiowa warriors facing him now. Moments before, he was resolved to take in as many of the guilty warriors as he could with him to hell. His mind, now racing with thought, battled with that decision. Jeb's actual murderers were the leeches, and his desire to punish him reigned above all others. If he walked away from this riverbank now, he could still hunt him down. These Indians were only the instruments of murder. The guilty parties were the leeches. It would be a sin to let them get away with the massacre they'd instigated. He turned and walked slowly back down the riverbank.
God damn, there's a whole lot of nothing in this country.
Garth rode up beside the wagon Jesse was driving.
Seems that way.
They'd been traveling for days with very little variation in the country before. Rolling hills of grass broken occasionally by ribbons of trees that told the existence of a stream. They were approaching one such ribbon at the time.
I told Ike to pull his wagon over by yonder stream. You follow him, we'll make camp there. It's getting late in the day, and God knows when we'll strike another stream.
I'll be damn glad when we get set of these wagons. My backside is sore from riding this seat.
We oughtn't be too many more days from Fort Lyon. The way I figure it, we ought to strike the river sometime tomorrow.
While Ike and Jesse pulled the wagons up side by side and unhitched the mules, Garth took the saddle off his horse and led it to the stream to drink.
Well, we best hobble these horses.
They had taken care to hobble their horses every night, but the mules had shown no inclination to stray, so they just let them out to graze with the horses. Later that evening, when they were finished their supper, Jesse frowned.
Reckon how come Joe ain't caught up with us yet? He should have caught us 2 days ago.
Oh, damn fool probably couldn't follow our trail.
Shit, anybody can follow the tracks these wagons make. I bet he's found him a little engine gal back in the Kiowa camp.
We better start watching our back trail a little more. Ain't lying when you say anybody can follow our wagon tracks.
You thinking about that partner of Hawkins, ain't you? Like I said before, I expect he's halfway back to Omaha by now.
Well, maybe. But he ain't the only one we got to worry about. There's Comanche, Cheyenne, and Kiowa out here looking for scalps.
You know what? I don't miss Joe a damn bit. But I do kind of miss Cora. She's a pretty good cook.
Yeah, when Joe left her alone long enough. Reckon why he shot her back there? Hell, we'd still have a cook if Joe hadn't killed her.
Well, it could have taught her a lesson with just a good hiding with a stout stick. But Joe's Joe. Couldn't stand the thought of anybody else just dipping in his sugar bowl.
Hell, I dipped into that bowl a time or two. Cora didn't like it, but I told her I'd kill her if she told. Well, I miss that more than I miss her cooking.
The next morning, Garth and Jesse were awakened by their brother Ike.
Damn! Son of a bitch! Dang blasted beast!
What the hell's got you so hot this morning, Ike?
Oh, the damn mules, that's what. Two of them run off while we were sleeping.
They ain't ever done that before. Oh, maybe some engines stole them.
You half-wit. If it was engines, they'd likely took the horses and probably scalped us in our beds to boot. If we'd have took turns standing guards like I said, we wouldn't be without two mules this morning.
Well, fussing ain't gonna get it done. Gotta find them mules. If we don't, we're gonna have to leave one of the wagons. Now, me and Ike will saddle up. Jesse, you stay here with the wagons.
They split up to search. Garth to the northeast, Ike to the northwest, since a few tracks were found heading generally in a northern direction. Jesse, content to stay in camp and drink coffee, made himself comfortable and awaited their return. Both riders were back by late morning, having given up when there was no sign of the missing mules to be found. With no other option, they loaded all the hides into one wagon with what whiskey and ammunition they had and set out again for Fort Lyon. Riding away from the Kiowa camp, Tanner had put a sizable distance between himself and the Indians before circling to pick up a trail. He had not scouted much ground before he found what he was looking for. Two sets of wagon ruts, still clearly etched in the short grass prairie. He paused briefly to look far ahead in the direction indicated. Then, his mind focused on the task he had set for himself, he started out on his trail of vengeance. He rode for 2 days, following the wagon tracks over the endless prairie, from campsite to noon stop to campsite again, stopping only when it became too dark to see. He could tell by the time of day he reached the campsites that he was rapidly gaining on his prey. Along his journey, he often sighted antelope in the distance, bounding away as he approached. But there was no thought about hunting now, at least not for antelope. His life had been reduced to one purpose, and he went about it doggedly. If he had been able to follow the tracks in the dark, he would have ridden on into the night. He'd been in the saddle no longer than a few hours on the third day when he followed the wagon tracks toward a thin line of cottonwood trees that apparently marked the stream. Riding up over a low ridge, he pulled ashes to a halt. There, by the stream, stood an abandoned wagon. The sight that made him hesitate to continue, however, was the four Indian ponies beside it, their riders busily scavenging through the wagon. His initial thought was that he may have been cheated, but there was only the one wagon, so it could have merely been abandoned by the leeches for whatever reason. He realized at that moment that he wouldn't be satisfied to have the three remaining brothers dead. They had to be dead by his hand. He remained stationary on the ridge for a few minutes longer, trying to decide what to do, whether to take a wide detour around the Indians or to ride down to see for himself that there were no bodies lying there. He hesitated too long, though, for one of the Indians suddenly stopped and looked in his direction, pointing. Like him, they seemed undecided as what they should do, too. The sudden appearance of a white man alone north of the Arkansas was certainly unexpected. Maybe he wasn't alone, and in fact was a scout for a large party of soldiers that followed. Maybe the wagon they had found was his wagon. There was damn good reason to be cautious until there were answers for some of these questions. For several long minutes, white man and Indian stood transfixed, watching each other. Still cautious, the four Cheyenne hunters jumped on their ponies and withdrew a few yards from the wagon. There, they pulled up again, still watching the lone white man on the ridge. After a short discussion, they wheeled their ponies, rode off through the cottonwood beside the stream, and disappeared beyond the ridge. Tanner remained still for a few moments after the Indians had gone. When it appeared they weren't coming back, he descended the ridge to have a look at the abandoned wagon. Upon walking around the wagon a couple of times, he could see no apparent damage. It looked to be a perfectly good wagon, causing him to wonder why it had been left behind. It had to be the mules, he decided. And he peered inside to see a few scattered, worthless items that had been rejected by the Indians. There was nothing that was of any interest to him. Close to the stream, he saw the signs of a campfire. A few yards away, there were fresh droppings where the horses and mules had evidently grazed. Extending his circle a little farther out, he found tracks leading away from the stream. Depth of the wagon ruts verified that the one remaining wagon was now carrying both loads. The tracks also told them that the leeches had changed their course to one of a more southerly direction, probably to strike the Santa Fe Trail. Looking at the tracks, he felt a renewed sense of urgency, for it was obvious to him that he was not far behind the three murderous brothers.
He is one man alone.
Burning Tree spoke as the four Cheyenne hunters peered down from the western ridge that bordered the shallow valley. On hands and knees in the prairie grass, Walksfast moved closer to the crest of the ridge to get a better look. Upon first spotting the white man on the ridge above them, they had been undecided on whether or not to run. At Burning Tree's suggestion, they decided to circle around to the east to see if there was indeed a cavalry patrol following the white man. He wore no uniform, but the army scouts were usually not soldiers, so he could have been a scout. Now, as they gazed down, watching him searching the wagon and campsite, they knew that he was alone.
I think he looks for the others who left the wagon. I say we should kill him and take his horses.
Walksfast nodded his agreement. The other two hunters quickly nodded as well, and all four crawled away from the top of the ridge to return to their ponies. Tanner had one foot in the stirrup and was about to throw the other over the saddle. Without taking time to think about it, he threw his leg over and kicked ashes hard. Four Cheyenne hunters raced down the opposite slope in an effort to cut him off. Looking back at his pursuers, he realized that Ashes was losing the race. The increasing strain on his right arm told him that the pack horse was holding him back. With the Indians steadily gaining on him, he had no choice but to drop the pack horse's rope. Ashes responded by increasing his speed, but Tanner could see that the big horse was beginning to tire. Taking another quick look behind him, he saw one of the pursuers break off and chase the pack horse. The other three galloped after him, their fast Indian ponies continuing to close the distance between them and the tiring gelt. As the distance decreased, the Indian's accuracy improved, the bullets getting closer and closer, until one finally ripped through Tanner's shirt, creasing his side. With no option left to him, he jerked Ash's rein sharply over when he came to a narrow gulch and pulled it to a sliding stop. Coming out of the saddle at once, he led his horse back into the gully. It was not deep enough to provide complete cover for Ashes, but Tanner figured the Indians hoped to capture the horse. Consequently, they would direct their fire away from him. As quickly as he could, he grabbed the Blakesley cartridge box from his saddle and scrambled up to the head of the gully. It was no more than knee-deep at the head, but it was enough to give him cover if he lay flat on his belly. Intent upon convincing his pursuers that he was not worth the risk of their lives, he took careful aim, waiting until he was absolutely sure of his target. Crow Killer tumbled over backward, landing wounded in the grass. Burning Tree and Walks Fast instinctively veered off to seek cover from the white man's rifle. Driving their ponies hard, they made their way over a high swale where they dismounted and clambered back up to firing positions. Coming behind, their companion leading Tanner's pack horse stopped short when he saw Crow Killer lying wounded on the ground. Making a fatal decision, Black Eagle dropped the pack horse's rope and slid off his pony.
Black Eagle, no!
Burning Tree and Walks Fast immediately sent several rounds cracking toward the gully in response to the white man's deadly fire. Already the price for the white man's horses was higher than they had been willing to pay. The two Cheyennes slid back from the brink of the swale.
This gun is too good. I don't have many cartridges left. I think maybe we had better leave this white man alone and take Black Eagle and Crow Killer back to the village.
I'm down to three cartridges. I think you're right. We can't get close enough to get a good shot at him.
I had hoped to capture his horse, but since we can't get close enough to kill the man, we can put him on foot.
Down in the gully, Tanner edged up closer to the lip in an attempt to keep the Indians from pinpointing his position. He was concerned that the two surviving warriors might be trying to circle around behind him. He looked up at the sky. The sun was already sinking low. If he could keep them at bay until dark, he would lead Ashes up the side of the ridge behind him.
Ashes!
Close to panic, Tanner scrambled back to tend the wounded horse. Unable to stand because he himself would then be a target, he tried to pull Ashes down on his knees. Two more bullets struck home on the horse. Mortally wounded, Ashes collapsed and rolled onto his side. Tanner, totally distraught with anger and disbelief, could do nothing to save the dying horse. He had counted on his attacker's desire to steal his horse. Unable to help beyond alleviating the horse's pain, he held his revolver to Ash's head.
Sorry, old boy.
Devastated by the loss of his horse, he sat there staring at the carcass for a moment before he called his mind back to the business of staying alive. Scrambling to the head of the gully again, he scanned the length of the swale across from him, searching for signs that the Indians had moved to new positions. There was no sign of them, but at least they couldn't approach his position without crossing 50 yards of open ground.
I guess we're just gonna wait each other out.
When darkness finally descended upon the gully, Tanner thought about his previous plan to steal away in the night. The thought now of being out in the open prairie on foot when his adversaries were on horseback did not seem wise. He had to admit he didn't know enough about his enemy to predict what the Indians would do. He had shot two of their number. They might wait all night in hopes of finally killing him in retaliation.
Or they might make a try sneaking up on me at night.
In the end, he decided to risk the latter. When darkness set in, He made his way back down the gully to position himself behind the horse's carcass. With his back against the end of the gully, he sat with his rifle laid across Ash's rump and his extra cartridges on the ground beside him. The night seemed endless. With time now to attend to the wound in his side, he took a look at it. There was a long slash where the bullet had creased him, but he decided it was not deep enough to cause any concern. Most of the blood had already dried. His wound taken care of, he had a lot of time to think about the road that had brought him to this dreary gully in the middle of a vast prairie. There were many regrets that filled his mind, but the dominant one was the fact that he was now delayed in his pursuit of Jeb's murderers. He'd been so close, and he blamed his lapse of caution for the predicament in which he now found himself. As soon as he'd seen the four Indians at the wagon, he should have retreated to take cover instead of sitting there until they spotted him. Fear that Garth Leach and his brothers would escape his vengeance was the only fear Tanner had. Waiting in his fortress of horse flesh, he promised anew his vow to Jeb Hawkins that he would be avenged, no matter how long and how far. He thought of the girl, Cora, and the brutal way her wretched life had ended. The world would choke on the miserable likes of the Leach brothers if it was not rid of them. He had no other purpose in life than to exterminate them, and he was determined to do it, no matter how many Indians he had to kill in the morning. Dark shadows turned to gray as morning finally approached the little valley. Soon, first light dissolved the shadows, clearing the night away. Stiff and tired, Tanner cautiously moved from his cramped position behind the carcass of his horse, lest someone might be waiting for him to show at the mouth of the gully. His rifle ready, he moved slowly toward the head of the grassy trench. Scanning the swale across from him, he could see no sign of anyone. Then, he discovered that the two bodies that had been on the valley floor were gone. They'd been removed during the night. The Indians had apparently quit the battle, although he found it hard to understand. Maybe he had made it too costly for him to pursue it. He could only guess. Maybe they were out of ammunition. He realized then that it was when they had shot his horse that they had decided to end the confrontation, choosing to leave him on foot in the middle of the prairie. Now certain that he was alone, he walked out onto the floor of the valley and slowly turned all the way around. The prairie seemed endless in every direction. A man without a horse in this vast expanse had little hope of survival. Walking up the swale, he found where the two Cheyenne hunters had taken positions to fire at him. Gazing back at the small gully across the narrow valley, he could understand the difficulty they'd had trying to target him. Down the other side of the swale, he found the place where their ponies had waited. Upon close inspection, he discovered the prints of more than their two ponies, and he surmised that they had gathered the other three horses during the night while he sat waiting for them in the gully. Studying the ground further, he was able to pick up the Indians' trail as they left the valley. It was not as easy to follow as the deep wagon tracks he had trailed for days, but made somewhat less difficult by the presence of one set of shod prints. The thought of following the tracks on foot seemed a bit absurd, but he could think of no better alternative.
I gotta find a horse. The only place I know where there is one is in that direction.
His decision made, he returned to the carcass in the gully to collect his belongings. It was a sad chore to leave ashes to feed the buzzards.
Thanks for all you've done for me. You were a good horse.
From his saddlebags, he took items of vital necessity, cartridges, flint, steel, and his canteen. His supply of food and coffee, along with the utensils to prepare it, had all been lost with his pack horse. Taking the section of buffalo hide he had rolled up behind his saddle, he made a pack to carry the item, using the reins from his bridle to secure it. deciding it was the best he could do, he paused to take a farewell look at his horse, carcass riddled with four bullet holes, one almost directly below the 08 brand. He shook his head sadly, turned, and set out to the north, his rifle in one hand, his small pack on his back. The one thought that plagued him was that he was turning away from the Leech Brothers' trail. A night without sleep and a day and a half without food began to take their toll on Tanner. With the sun directly overhead and a cloudless summer sky, he was no longer trotting, but he was still walking at a steady pace. He pushed on, doggedly determined to follow the trail left by the five horses. He was a strong man, but he realized by the middle of the afternoon that he must soon have food and rest. Pitiless Kansas sun seemed intent upon sapping him of every ounce of water in his body, and with his canteen less than half full, this became a serious concern. Still, he pushed his tired body onward, for there was no other alternative other than to sit down and die. By late afternoon, his concentration had come to focus totally upon placing one weary foot after the other. At one point, he realized that he had lost his fixation on the hoof prints he followed. Instead, he had begun following the general contours of the prairie, taking the easiest and most direct route through the rolling plain. The realization stunned him for a few moments. He paused to look around him in the short grass. Then he saw the faint print where his shod pack horse had mashed down the grass. The Indians had taken the easiest route as well. He was still on their trail, although it was a matter of sheer luck. He berated himself for letting his concentration stray. As the sun began sinking toward the horizon, he spied a broken line in the endless prairie ahead. His weary mind was a little slow in registering the fact that the broken line was, in fact, a line of trees, which meant a stream lay ahead. It was a tired man that reached the little stream bordered by willow trees and berry bushes. After he made a fire, he sat down to give his feet some attention. The boots he wore were not made for walking, and they had already been showing signs of wearing out even before his forced walk. The stitching had worn through, allowing the soles to separate in several places. He couldn't help but wonder if he was going to be walking across Kansas barefoot before much longer. Burning Tree led the horses up from the river. The summer sun was not kind to the bodies tied across the backs of the two horses. Already, Black Eagle and Crow Killer were swollen, and Burning Tree was afraid that they would soon begin to smell. It was still a day's ride to their village on the Smoky Hill, and they would have already been there had they not stopped here in this tributary.
I think we have lingered here longer than we should have.
You're right. I know we should have gotten back as soon as possible, but we could not ignore the good fortune sent our way.
They had been a long time away from their village since starting out on this hunting trip. Their luck had been poor, causing them to ride farther and farther south in search of game. Then their luck had gotten even worse when they found the abandoned wagon. There was nothing of value in the wagon, and the time wasted there resulted in the chance encounter with the white man with the medicine gun. A fatal meeting, the encounter led to the deaths of Crow Killer and Black Eagle. Even though it was important to hurry back to the village with the bodies of their two friends, it would have been extremely hard to keep riding when they happened upon a large herd of deer near a tributary of the Smoky Hill. It was the first sign of good fortune, and in two short days, they packed all the meat and hides they could manage on the white man's horse they had captured.
I think the spirit of the deer felt sorry for our loss, and we would have insulted him if we had not accepted his gift.
Perhaps you're right. It's late now, though. We'll start back in the morning.
By the look of the campsite, Tanner came upon the next day. He was able to construct a picture in his mind. They'd stopped here for more than one night to hunt, it appeared. The remains of several good-sized deer were discarded by the river, and the scraps of meat and entrails were already being eaten by a flock of buzzards that ignored Tanner. He stooped to check the ashes in the campfire, and he found them still warm.
2 or 3 hours.
Tanner gazed upriver where the tracks led.
Close.
With his stamina somewhat restored after sleeping all night and finding some nourishment courtesy of a careless muskrat, he had taken to the trail again that morning with sore feet but renewed resolve. The remains of the Indian's kill left no doubt that they had dined more elegantly than he. Muskrat was not to his liking. Encouraged by the knowledge that they had left this camp no more than 2 or 3 hours before, he immediately set out again. The tracks told him that they were simply following the river, so he continued following the river as well, feeling certain that he would overtake them by walking through the oncoming night. Walks Fast stirred in his sleep. Something had awakened him. He rose up on one elbow and listened for sounds. On the other side of the fire, Burning Tree was still sleeping. Thinking it was nothing, Walks Fast was about to lie down again. He had heard something. Maybe a wolf or a coyote had caused the ponies to signal danger. Sitting up, he reached for his rifle and got to his feet.
Stand real still. You understand white man talk?
Walks Fast nodded.
I just want a horse.
Tanner noticed that the other Indian was now waking up.
Tell your friend to stay where he is and he won't get hurt. You Kiowa?
Cheyenne.
Cheyenne, huh? Well, I got no quarrel with the Cheyenne. But you attacked me and shot my horse. All I want from you is a horse and I'll leave you be.
Fully awake now and aware of what was taking place, Burning Tree rested a hand on his rifle and slowly rose to one knee.
You killed 2 warriors. You tried to kill me. So I figure we're square as long as I get a horse. I reckon you best drop that rifle on the ground. If you hadn't awoken up, you just lost 1 horse and I'd have been gone.
What makes you think you can kill both of us before one of us shoots you? You are a foolish white man to come here. You will die here.
Nobody has to die. But if you raise that rifle, I'll cut you down where you stand.
A thin smile began to spread across Burning Tree's face an instant before he suddenly jerked his rifle. As soon as he pulled the trigger, Tanner dived onto the ground and rolled over. In his haste to shoot, Walks Fast missed the sprawling white man. Tanner cautiously rose to one knee, his eyes scanning back and forth between the 2 bodies on the ground. When there was no sign of life from either, he rose to his feet and walked over to Burning Tree's body.
I didn't come to kill you, but you forced my hand. You could have just given me a horse. That's all I wanted.
Looking over the camp, he wasted little time in making decisions. With 5 horses to choose from, he quickly picked a stout mottled gray pony as his first choice, since it had lines similar to Ash's. Having no desire to bother with herding 4 horses, he decided to take his pack horse and a paint pony. He stood before the remaining 2 ponies, still tied to a cottonwood limb, and loaded with their grim cargo.
I ain't got time to worry about the dead.
He cut the rope that secured him to the horses. Rigor mortis had already set in, causing the corpses to hang stiffly in place. Grabbing them by the feet, he gave each body a shove and dumped it on the ground. Then he removed the pony's bridles and released them. Next, he dumped a load of venison from his pack horse, keeping only enough to eat before it spoiled. Mottled gray pony was decidedly skittish when Tanner approached him, backing away while eyeing the strange white man cautiously. Afraid the horse might suddenly bolt, Tanner paused to consider the possibility that he might wind up chasing the horse on foot. Stepping back a few feet, he looked around to find a couple of parfleshes near the buffalo robes that had served as beds.
That might do.
He picked up one of the robes. When he turned to approach the horse again, the sole of his boot flapped loose, and he almost tripped. Taking a moment to look at the worn-out boot, he decided to see if he could find replacements for him, figuring anything would be an improvement. The pair that came closest to fitting his feet was on one of the corpses he had dumped from the ponies. His feet were so sore that he didn't bother to be concerned about the sores. The buffalo robe held the odor of campfire smoke with a hint of something like green bark. He decided it was not unpleasant. With the robe in hand, moving slowly, he cautiously advanced toward the wary gray. Uncertain, the horse took another step backward as Tanner came near, but it didn't bolt. Carefully reaching for the reins, which were no more than a rope looped around the pony's lower jaw with a half hitch, he held the horse steady. The gray didn't fight him, but it still eyed him suspiciously. Tanner moved in close and rubbed the robe against the horse's muzzle, letting it smell the familiar odor of the Indian. Tanner had no idea which Indian the horse had belonged to, but the gray seemed satisfied to accept him as a friend.
Attaboy, you're gonna be all right.
He stroked the horse's neck for a few minutes before climbing up in the saddle made of wood and buffalo hide.
Good boy. We'll see how you take to a real bridle and saddle.
He didn't take the time to ride his new horse before hitching a line between the paint and his pack horse. He figured he and the gray could get accustomed to each other on the way back to the gully, where he intended to pick up his saddle. With one last look at the scene of carnage he was leaving, he shook his head.
All I came for was a horse.
Retracing his journey of the past few days, he found his new mount to be exceptionally nimble, and certainly quicker than Ash's had been, an asset he was already aware of, remembering how the Cheyenne had steadily gained on Ash's during their chase down the valley. He couldn't say the Indian saddle was entirely uncomfortable, but he knew that he definitely preferred his own. The next day, he introduced the gray to a bit, having kept his bridle to fashion a backpack with the reins. The horse fought the bridle, trying to expel the hard bit repeatedly, but in the end, he accepted it. There was no danger that Tanner might have difficulty finding the little gully where he had held off the Cheyenne attack. The site of the battle was clearly marked when he was still a mile distant by the ring of buzzards flying overhead. When he crested the last rise, where the Indians had positioned themselves before, he was revolted by the feast taking place below in the gully. Giving the gray his heels, he galloped down the slope. The sudden charge of the three horses toward him was enough to cause the buzzards to take flight. Working as quickly as he could, Tanner unbuckled the girth strap on the saddle. Unwilling to further witness the devouring of his horse, he loaded the saddle on his shoulder and led the three horses up the valley, away from the feast.
Well, looks like the cards just ain't your friends tonight, mister.
The speaker was a rotund man with a bald pate. Garth Leach had just lost another large pot to a pair of kings.
I didn't catch your name.
I didn't give it.
The cards had not favored him with one winning hand since he joined the three men at the table. The round, bald man on his right had enjoyed no better luck than Garth, but he had always folded early instead of staying in and calling the last raise on each hand. The bony, dark-haired man in the frock coat seated across from him seemed to be the one Lady Luck was smiling upon this evening. The fourth player had won a couple of small pots, but he was probably showing a loss for the evening, too. As the stack of gold coins grew across the table, Garth's anger continued to rise. He could not, he would not accept the loss of any of the gold coins he had taken from Jeb Hawkins. While the bald man shuffled the cards, the man in the frock coat picked up one of the coins and examined it.
Well, I haven't seen coins like these around here. How did you happen to come by them?
I don't see that as any of your business. You gonna shuffle the faces off them cards?
Baldy immediately offered the deck to be cut.
Deal 'em.
The cards dealt, Garth watched with suspicious eyes as each man discarded. He discarded two, holding a jack, a nine, and a ten. Frockcoat discarded only one card. Garth's brother Ike walked over to the table as new cards were dealt. He stood there watching for a moment, sizing up his brother's losses.
You ain't doing too good, are you?
Shut up!
I'm heading back. When are you coming?
Ike was not pleased with the sight of the pile of coins across the table, and he was worried that Garth might lose more than his share of the gold coins. He knew that Garth didn't have the brains to win at cards. Garth didn't answer until he looked at his two new cards.
Right now, I'm done here.
He stood up and shoved his chair away from the table. Fearful that some form of violence was about to erupt, the round, bald man leaned away from the table, figuring that if the huge man exploded, the force of the explosion would be directed at Garner, the man in the frock coat. Garner, equally concerned for his safety, had taken the precaution of pulling a double-barreled Derringer from his boot just as soon as Garth stood up. He held it under the table until Garth turned around and followed Ike out the front door of the saloon.
Oh, damn, Gardner. You picked a hell of a man to clean out tonight. I thought for a minute we was all gonna get shot. That man's got a mean streak in him a mile wide.
Garner smiled and held the Derringer up for the others to see.
Yeah, I was ready to use it if he came at me. He acted like I was cheating. Now, the fact is, he just ain't a very good poker player.
The men played a few more hands of poker, and then the game broke up. Garner, realizing that the big man with the beard could easily be waiting for him out front, stepped into the dark alley behind the saloon. There was a dank odor of urine hanging over the alleyway, as this was the place where most of Jake's patrons completed the final processing of his beer and whiskey. Garner turned and ran headlong into the dark bulk of Jesse Leach.
Oh!
At once terrified, Garner staggered backward, thinking it was Garth.
I was just lucky.
He quickly realized that the imposing form before him was not the belligerent man at the poker table.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were somebody else.
Oh, just lucky, was you? Well, your luck's run out. How you like this kind of luck?
Jesse stepped back and let Garner's body crumple to the ground. A moment later, Jesse appeared at the front corner of the saloon.
Did you get all my money?
All our damn money?
Ike was still irritated that Garth had gambled with a sack of gold coins found in Jeb Hawkins' saddlebag.
Did you get my money?
Yeah, I got it. Them coins and more to boot. That fella had a sizable stash of paper money on him.
What'd you do with him?
There was a hook outside the back door. I hung him up by his collar. Won't that pucker the first fella's ass that walks out the door?
You dumb shit! Why didn't you drag him off in the bushes somewhere? When they find him, they're liable to come looking for us.
What if they do? What are they gonna do about it? There ain't no law in this town.
Oh, maybe so. But a lot of these little towns have a vigilante committee, and they just love to have necktie parties every chance they get.
Well, you let me worry about that.
Well, that's just it, brother. I figure I'd just as soon worried about my share of things myself. You lost a lot of gold in there tonight. Some of it my share, some Jesse's. What if that feller had slipped away somewhere where we couldn't have found him?
But he didn't.
But he coulda. Anyway, damn it, I'll be holding my share of money from now on. We got a sizable sum right now with them coins and the sale of them hides. I don't want my share to disappear in no damn poker game.
Garth said nothing for a long moment. his eyebrows lowered over dark eyes that glowered at Ike, causing Ike to drop his hand to rest on the handle of his pistol. His brother's authority had never been challenged before, although Ike had quite often questioned his decisions. Garth was the oldest, the biggest, and by far the meanest. He had been the undisputed leader of the family ever since the brothers were boys. There had been many times when he had seen fit to administer physical punishment if his orders were not satisfactorily obeyed, but there had never been outright mutiny. Now, within a few weeks' time, Joe would split off to remain with Yellow Calf's Kiowa, and Ike was threatening his authority.
You saying you're the one to give the orders round here?
No, I ain't talking about giving orders to nobody. I'm just saying I aim to have what's rightfully mine.
Garth glanced at Jesse, standing with mouth agape while his brothers faced off. Then he looked back at Ike, whose hand still rested on his pistol. If it had been Joe or Jesse, Garth would have simply kicked the hell out of him, and that would have been the end of the insolence. But Ike was different. Lean and hard, Ike was as lethal as a rattlesnake, and Garth knew he would not hesitate to draw that pistol if Garth or God Almighty or anybody else threatened him. Garth considered his next move carefully before he spoke again.
All right. But let's get the hell back to camp before somebody finds that body.
Back in camp, the two brothers resumed the discussion started outside the saloon. An interested and mystified spectator, Jesse busied himself playing with the campfire, not realizing the seriousness of his older brother's disagreement. With plenty of cash in their possession, they could have afforded to stay in a hotel, had there been one in the rough city near the confluence of the South Platte and Cherry Creek. After selling the load of buffalo hides at Fort Lyon, wagon, mules, and all, they had not lingered. Too many soldiers for their liking. There had been some minor discussion between Garth and Ike before this, with Ike ready to move on to a mining settlement 30 miles north of Denver City. But Garth favored remaining in Denver City. There was gold being taken from Cherry Creek, and the tent city was wild and lawless, an environment that suited Garth's nature. After looking the area over, Garth had picked a spot on the creek close to a mining claim run by two old men. Jesse still had to smile when he thought of the reaction of the two men when they got a look at their new neighbors. Jesse was concerned that Joe had not caught up to him at Fort Lyon, but Garth had said they would wait for him in Denver City. It had been quite a while, and still Joe hadn't shown up. Jesse had to figure Joe was enjoying teepee living with that little Kiowa girl who had dressed his wound. But his thoughts of his younger brother were forgotten when he was distracted by sounds of the argument heating up between his two brothers.
I say we stay here for a spell while the pickings are good. And damn it, I'm the one who decides.
Not anymore, you ain't. Leastways, not for me. I'm heading up to Black Horse Creek. They're just starting to pull gold out of there, and this place here ain't gonna last long. It'll be dried up for next winter.
The two brothers locked eyes for a few tension-filled moments, and Jesse thought they were about to kill each other.
Damn it, Garth. You're my brother, and I don't want to cause no trouble between us. But I want to be my own man, and so help me, I'll not hesitate to put a bullet between your eyes if you try and stop me.
Ain't no use in one of us getting killed. You go your own way. Me and Jesse will stay here for a spell. We'll split the money up right now. Joe ain't here yet, but he gets an equal share. I'll keep it for him till he catches up.
Oh, that's just mighty Christian of you.
When you planning on leaving?
In the morning, I reckon. I ain't no hurry. You're welcome to go with me if you want to.
I expect I'll stay with Garth.
I don't know about you, brother, but I think we put in a pretty good day's work.
Travis Bland sat down on the step beside his brother.
I'm thinking another day or two and we'll have her done. Plenty of time before the really cold weather sets in.
Looks that way.
Trenton reached down beside the step and picked up a jug that had been resting there.
You ought to take it easy with that stuff. You've been hitting it pretty heavy lately.
I'm only drinking after the work's done. It ain't slowing me down none.
It ain't no way to go home to your wife.
Hell, she'd rather have me pass out drunk.
That ain't no way to talk about Ellie. You ain't still thinking about her and Tanner, are you? Hell, they were just kids then. You got yourself a fine wife. You ought to appreciate it.
Oh, I do. I appreciate it a lot.
Travis gazed at him for a moment before shaking his head in exasperation and getting to his feet.
I'm ready for some supper. You coming?
I think I'll sit here for a while. I'll see you in the morning.
Trenton waited until Travis disappeared past the corner of the field before lifting the jug again. He welcomed the sting of the strong whiskey on his throat. He only wished it could burn away the agony he felt in his heart. Travis had said that Tanner and Ellie were just kids before, but they were not kids when they had become engaged to be married before the war interrupted their plans. Trenton felt like he'd cheated Tanner, although that was not what he had meant to do. He loved his brother, and he had stolen his wife. Although he had never confided this to anyone, this was the real cause for his bitterness.
If I was half a man, I'd go after him and set things right.
He feared that regret would curse him for the rest of his life. Tanner was gone, his father said, to Kansas. And who knew where beyond that? Trenton picked up the jug again. Tanner Bland held the Indian pony to a steady pace, knowing he had lost a lot of time, but also knowing that time made no difference in this hunt. He was determined to track down the other three murderers, no matter the time it took. After striking the Arkansas, he followed it west into Colorado territory, until he came to what he assumed was Fort Lyon. He was told by a soldier driving a wagon that the place was actually Bent's new fort. Fort Lyon was a mile beyond. Upon reaching Fort Lyon, he looked for the stables or a blacksmith, reasoning that the leeches might have had need for one or the other.
I expect I know the three you're looking for.
Bill Bramble, the blacksmith, spoke in response to Tanner's inquiry.
A man ain't likely to forget them three. Two of them as big as buffaloes and the other as lean as a whip. Buffalo hunters. At least I reckon that's what they was. They sold a whole wagon load of buffalo hides. Then they came over to my place and sold me their wagon and mules. I give them next to nothing for that outfit, but they took it. And I think I heard him talking about heading to Denver City. Are they friends of yours?
Nope.
I reckon you'll be looking for a place to board them horses.
Nope. They'll be moving on to Denver City.